This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Two people that we know very well are reporting at the moment from Los Angeles on the wildfires. Emma Vardy from the BBC, David Blevins reporting for Sky, both well known here for their coverage of Belfast and Dublin. Now they're in LA. We speak to them about what it's like to be covering this story. How dangerous is it? What's it like behind the scenes? Back here, we're talking about flags and whether the Republic should consider changing its flag if there is ever a United Ireland. And even closer to home, near our BBC studio here, Belfast City Airport, and some changes they've brought in terms of the drop-off zones. Some people have been fined up to £100 for letting people off in the wrong place. What exactly is going on? Why are Belfast City Airport doing it? It's health and safety, they tell us. Is it fair? You have your say. Have a listen. The Stephen Nolan Show! Morning. As we've been hearing, the number of people killed in the wildfires in Los Angeles has risen to 24. It is a very dangerous place to be, including for reporters who are bringing us updates day and night. Two of them are very well known here, the BBC's Emma Vardy and David Blevins from Sky News. We're going to hear now from both of them, starting with Emma Vardy. As we know, Emma was based in Belfast as the BBC's Ireland correspondent before moving to LA. She's been spearheading the BBC's coverage on the 10 o'clock news and other outlets for the past week or so, and she told me what it's been like.
Hi there, Mark. Good morning from LA. I've just got in after a sixth long day of covering these fires, and it's just been absolutely relentless, unbelievable, exhausting. I mean, I don't want to overuse the Hollywood metaphors, but every time we drive around, I just feel like this looks like a Hollywood disaster movie. I mean, we're seeing these vast scenes of devastation in an iconic city. Nobody could have believed we'd be looking at this until it happened. And when you're covering it, oh, you're in the thick of the smoke. Sometimes we've been up canyons and roads with fires burning on both sides. But, you know, we try to minimise the danger, but it's the only real way to witness properly the scale of this and what's going on and the way that the firefighters are fighting it. So it's incredible. But it takes it out of you. My eyes have been stinging. Everything smells of smoke. But I just hope that we're able to convey to people back home just some sense of just the enormity of what this city is going through, because there's still no end in sight. And I can't believe it as much as anyone. I mean, it feels like just a few days ago after Christmas, I was in Belfast seeing friends and family and just having a great time, and then flew back from Dublin to LA couple of days, and then suddenly, bang, we're into this, what feels like the apocalypse. And I just hasn't really sunk in for me even the enormity of it yet. I think that LA has, well, I'm into my second year in LA, so it definitely has become home for me. And so a lot of the places that I'm now reporting on are places that I've come to love. They're surf spots that I go to, little places that I hang out afterwards, some really glitzy, glamorous places that I've gone through and taken selfies to show friends. Look, we're in Malibu, or, you know, we're in the world of celebrities. And yet it's just dust and ash now. You know, of course, lots of ordinary people are suffering too. But there's just something weird about seeing a place of that's worth billions and billions, and where you think of the rich and famous as being kind of untouchable, them being in the middle of this disaster just as much as anybody else. Now, I know a few people have been asking about the mask that I've never seen without at the moment, and the yellow suit. I know I do look a bit like a minion on the news sometimes, but we are standing in places where the flames are sometimes almost licking our ankles. There are bits of brush alight right next to us, even in places where the fire or the heart of the fire has moved on. Buildings are still smoking for days, and bits of these buildings still burst into life. The flames just burst into life when the wind blows. So everywhere is really dangerous. The smoke is in the air for absolutely miles, and as soon as you get out the car, you're breathing it in. So we are wearing these masks to try to protect ourselves as much as possible. And the suits, of course, they make us look like we're dressing up like firefighters. We're not. They're just the flame retardant outfits that all journalists have got access to try to keep us safe, because we are in some spots where the fire can just move really, really quickly. So everybody's taking these precautions. And I also know a lot of people have been making the comparison that just a few days, well, really less than 48 hours before the fires kicked off, I was standing on the red carpet at the Golden Globes, the award ceremony in Beverly Hills. And one minute I was in this sequin dress, showing off with bottles of champagne and living the dream and, you know, experiencing that side of the job of being LA correspondent, and then suddenly thrown into this. And I couldn't have believed it if you told me this a week ago. But this is a job where you do have to go from the red carpet to just anything that is thrown at you. But I never would have guessed that it was going to be this. And since covering the fires, I mean, I've heard from a lot of people back in Northern Ireland, friends, other journalists I work with, people in the world of politics. Lots of people have been reaching out to me from Belfast and around Northern Ireland just to say hi, just to see how I'm doing and to say that they're watching the coverage. And it's really nice to hear from lots of people back in Belfast, because you feel a long way away from home in a moment like this. It feels so alien and so strange. It's really nice to hear from everyone back in Northern Ireland and to know that people are watching, because I just hope people are able to see what I'm seeing, because it's an incredible, historic disaster for LA. And there's going to be some lessons to learn from this too, whether that's about climate change or how we prepare for fires or just the effect that they can have. We think of disasters happening, sadly, in poor parts of the world, don't we? It's what happens. But this is just showing you it can happen to the rich and famous too. And it's an extraordinary disaster moment in history to witness. I will say, after seeing, you know, a week of this devastation, block after block of just ruined neighbourhoods, I almost get a little numb to it. But then all of a sudden, something hits you that really humanises it. Just yesterday, we were driving through a street where all the cars had clearly been abandoned in a panic, and they were just they were in funny positions, and some had crashed into each other. And again, it looked like a scene from the disaster movie when everybody panics and gets out their car and starts running. And you could just feel the panic that people would have been in at that moment when they realized the fire was getting closer and closer, and they just abandoned cars and in a state of fear. And I could just feel that fear as we just saw the aftermath of these cars left on the street. And today I interviewed a woman who'd lost her son in the fire, and it was just heartbreaking that the fire had moved too quickly. They weren't able to get him out in time. And she asked me, she asked the fire crews, would he have burnt? Would he have felt fear and pain? And they told her that no, he probably would have passed out, most likely from the fumes, from the smoke before that. But just hearing people think about these terrible things, I don't want to upset your listeners too early in the morning, but you know, when you're watching this for hours, there are just these moments that stay with you, that just bring it back home about the reality of this and the people in these situations. So I hope we will see an end to it as soon as possible, to salvage what's left of these parts of LA which are destroyed. But it is impossible to know right now where the end is, because this could go on for many more days.
Sadly, it could. Emma, stay safe out there. That was Emma Vardy talking to me earlier this morning. David Blevins from Sky is still out there, although David is best known for his reports from Belfast and Dublin for Sky News, I think for more than 30 years now. David knows America well. He's got good contacts there. He works there quite a bit. Sky fly him out, and they flew him out again to cover the New Year period. And his attempt to interview the mayor of LA went viral on social media. We'll come to that in a moment. But first, the big picture. David told me about reporting on those fires for the past week.
Hello, Mark. Well, it has been difficult mentally, physically, and to be brutally honest, emotionally. It's just difficult getting your head around the scale of what has happened in Los Angeles. The occupants of 12,000 homes have lost the roof over their head and all of their material possessions. So that's a lot of trauma. The firefighters are absolutely exhausted, and yet the fire rages on, and there is a warning that it could get worse again in the next few days. And in addition to that, then you will know the risk involved in covering an unpredictable wildfire. So you have to focus a lot on keeping yourself safe and making sure your team is safe. And while we're doing that, we are listening every day to people's stories, and they are heartbreaking stories. You and I have had the privilege for many years of talking to presidents and prime ministers and first ministers, but I always say it is the stories of the ordinary people who are enduring extraordinary situations that live with you, that remain with you, that come to mind when you put your head on the pillow at the end of the day. So challenging for all sorts of reasons. I'm not sure anything could prepare you for what we've witnessed this week. You've heard reporters use terms like apocalyptic scenes. That's not an exaggeration. Or say things like Altadena and Pacific Palisades resemble a war zone. They do. But we're not in a war zone, of course. We're in California, where these things are not supposed to happen. I suppose what covering Northern Ireland has given me is an experience of meeting with and hearing from and trying to tell the stories of people who have been broken by the tragic loss of their loved ones. 2 days ago, I stood with a woman in Altadena who told me her 82-year-old father was so sure the fire wouldn't reach his home, he'd gone to bed. But the fire did reach his home and he died in bed, and he's still in it, she says. Those are haunting words. And I said, I'm so sorry for your loss. To which she replied, no, thank you for coming to tell my story. So I hope the experience of reporting Northern Ireland has given me an ability to, for a moment, at least try to step into someone else's shoes, to be empathetic in how we report in these circumstances.
It is heartbreaking stuff, all of the reports, including David's from LA. I also asked him, though, about the politics. That encounter with the mayor of Los Angeles, he bumped into her on a plane. He recorded his encounter. It went viral then on social media. David gave me the background to that encounter.
Madam Mayor, David Blevins from Sky News in the UK.
I'm not going to
Fire chiefs say that they're really stretched to the limit and running out of water. What have you got to say to that? Have you no response to that? Do you owe citizens an apology for being absent while their homes were burning? Do you regret cutting the fire department budget by millions of dollars, Madam Mayor? Have you nothing to say today? Have you absolutely nothing to say to the citizens today? Elon Musk says that you're utterly incompetent. Are you considering your position? Sometimes you have to go looking for the story, and sometimes the story comes to you. We had to leave Washington at very short notice on Wednesday to cover the fires. My cameraman Michael was sitting at the front of the plane. The producer Eleanor and I were sitting at the back of the plane. And about halfway through the flight to LA, Michael walked down the aisle and said, I think the mayor of LA is sitting beside me. And she was. So we hatched this plan to try and doorstep her when she stepped into the terminal. But when the plane landed and the door opened, we realised her security detail were going to greet her and take her out through a door to the side of the air bridge. So we had to move very quickly. To be honest, I thought she would say something like, well, my heart goes out to the community, but I'm not in a position to give an interview. I'll make a statement later. But she just stood in absolute silence while I asked questions. And that 90-second clip has now been viewed millions upon millions of times because Americans seem to be shocked by the idea that a journalist would ask questions of a politician. But isn't that what we're supposed to do?
It certainly is. Thanks to David. Thanks to Emma. If you're listening, I know you're sleeping at the moment. If you're listening on BBC Sounds, listening back to yourselves, you maybe don't have time, but stay safe. We can hear the wind in the background when David was speaking there, and that's part of the problem. That is fanning the flames. But you'll get the very latest on Sky News from David and on BBC News from Emma. Now to a story that they have covered many times over the years, flags. And the reason we're covering it is because over the weekend, there was quite a sparky debate online after an article that the Belfast Telegraph's Sam McBride wrote. He wrote an article saying that he thinks it's going to be very, very difficult for unionists ever to swallow the Irish tricolour, even if there is a United Ireland. And part of the evidence he drew to try to support his argument was remarks that were made at the end of last year by Judith Gillespie. You may remember her, the former Deputy Chief Constable with the PSNI. She retired, 10 years ago? And recently she spoke to the Royal Irish Academy. And she spoke about one of her new jobs after the PSNI, which was working for the Irish Policing Authority in Dublin. And she talked about going to one of their meetings.
When I started with the Garda Policing Authority, I walked into the boardroom on my first day as a member of the policing authority, and in the corner of the room was an Irish tricolour. And I had this almost visceral reaction in my stomach that I'm working for an organisation which has the Irish tricolour in the corner. And then I had to say to myself, Judith, wise up. You know, this is the Republic of Ireland and that's their flag. Get over yourself. But it was, you know, a very, as I say, in the pit of my stomach reaction, not something that I actively thought about. It was visceral.
That context is very important. You can listen to the full remarks from Judith Gillespie. They're on YouTube. It is a very interesting discussion that she had at the Royal Irish Academy. She talked about that she almost couldn't help herself because it didn't reflect what her brain was saying, but it seemed to be like a gut reaction that there was this opposition to the Irish flag. Sam McBride, you talked about this at the weekend. Were you maybe a little unfair to Judith Gillespie because she talked about it was almost a subconscious reaction? It doesn't reflect her political beliefs.
No, I don't think I could possibly be accused of being unfair on this occasion because I made that very clear in the article. I mean, I think I pretty much quoted everything she said about this. So just to put this in some context, she was talking at the Royal Irish Academy. She was talking to Richard English, very distinguished academic from Queen's University, as part of a wider series of events trying to build understanding across the border of different people, different identities, because this is a small island, but we actually don't understand each other very well, even though we often think we do. And it was very interesting. I'm not sure when I last heard somebody in public life in Northern Ireland speak with such raw honesty, not just about this, but about other topics in that interview. It was very, very straight. And there was no sense of her trying to spin things in a particular way or trying to make any sort of bigger political point here. I've no idea what her politics are. I don't know if she's a unionist, if she's a nationalist, if she's other. She was speaking with really raw honesty, saying, look, this happened. You could see it in her face. She genuinely didn't understand why it happened, but this is how she felt, and people need to understand this. And that, I think, is significant.
But you have taken a massive leap and said, and that shows that unionists would never accept a tricolour in a United Ireland.
No, I have referred to other very significant evidence from polling, north and south, as to what people think about the flag. This is somebody who is about as moderate a person outside of people who have said they're unionist or nationalist. Someone who has, as a senior police officer, made the leap from the RUC to the PSNI, somebody who herself learned the Irish language to try to show respect for young recruits who were coming in so that she could have a better sense of them, even something as basic, she says, as being able to speak their names properly. That's the level of care that she took. She's the daughter of somebody who was a very significant peacemaker in North Belfast. She grew up on the Catholic side of a very difficult interface. There's so much about her background that makes clear she is not a hardline unionist. She's not a typical person who you might think would say something like this. And she's being very honest. But actually, the truth is that there's an awful lot more people in Northern Ireland who are unionist, who are much more strongly opposed to the Irish flag than she is. So you've got this spectrum of people. We know from polling that it's very significant within unionism. But what I was trying to say to a largely Southern audience in the Sunday Independent was, look, here is somebody who is so moderate, and this is how she feels about it, and she's being honest about it. What do you think are the chances that this is a runner if there is a United Ireland?
Before we widen out the debate, I've put a lot of words into your mouth. Let's hear from you. What are you saying, Sam? That the tricolour has to go?
No, I'm not saying it has to go, it has to stay. I'm just trying to analyse what is there. We've got this situation where there are two flags on this island that were designed as compromises. The Irish tricolour has a really, really amazing story behind it. The idea of green and orange and being brought together with white in the centre, that's a wonderful idea, but it hasn't worked. It has not been accepted by the people who that compromise was aimed at. There is a second flag, the Union flag, which was aimed as a compromise. It brings in the Scottish, the Welsh, the English, and the Irish through the cross of St. Patrick. It is meant to be some sort of compromise. It clearly hasn't worked. It has not been accepted. We can continue to say that's the way it is and that's the way it always will be. But if people are actually serious about building a new Ireland, as lots of people now say they are, not just bolting Northern Ireland onto the Republic, as lots of people thought about in years gone by, but building a completely new country, what does that mean? And this gets to the heart of that. On one level, this is a piece of cloth. Who cares what the flag is, you might say. The truth is, an awful lot of people care about it. There are people who are willing to die for a flag in war. There's people who are willing to show great respect to a flag in terms of how they handle it. This symbolizes, this emblemizes how our personal identity, our national identity, our sense of who we are, who our neighbors are. There's an awful lot bound up in a flag. And that's why this matters. There are people, and you're not doing this, but there are people who sneer at this and say, why don't you write about the health service? Why don't you write about education? Of course, we write about all those things. Flags are very important to people. If they weren't, then this wouldn't be a problem.
Let's talk about this, and let's talk about the issue, which is the gut reaction. The gut reaction, and Sam McBride makes the point that it may be a gut reaction to the Union flag too. But it is important, and we want to hear your thoughts. Give us a call, 03030805555. We'll get a quick word with the former Sinn Féin candidate, Chris Donnelly, and the former Democratic Unionist Party special advisor, David Graham, before the 9:30 news. But we do want to keep you involved as well. Keep your calls coming in. Quick word with Chris Donnelly on this, and then David. Chris.
Good morning, Mark, first of all, and Sam. What people hear, and I read, it was very interesting, Sam's article yesterday. And I have to preface this by saying something very clearly. What people hear when they read Sam's article is unionism wanting to have its cake and to eat it. The article's headline was, "Unionists will never accept the tricolour as their flag in United Ireland." And then, ad verbatim, it said, "The fact most in the South are unlikely to budge on issue is just another barrier to change." Now, there's a very clear implication in that unionists, firstly, are entitled and have the right to demand a change to Ireland's national flag and have a veto over unity because they will never accept the tricolour. And secondly, that there's a clear implication that refusing to change a flag is somehow an unreasonable act, which is a barrier to constitutional change. As if people, if they wanted to keep the tricolour, were acting contrary to reconciliation. Now, there's an obvious there's an obvious answer to all this. What is the national flag of the United Kingdom? Has it been changed to reflect the identity of the nationalist community in the north of Ireland since partition? Has it been changed since Good Friday Agreement? Of course it hasn't. And it hasn't been raised by any unionist commentators or any unionist politicians that the fact that the union flag is still the sovereign flag of the United Kingdom, that that is something that is against reconciliation, okay, or that is something that we must see change. So what we're very much saying, and this is very important, this is a matter of framing.
Okay.
And what we are seeing in this pre-border poll era is an endeavouring by some to repackage the unionist veto. We've seen it in the whole discussion around 50% plus one principle should be changed. We've seen it in the discussion last year, I think very striking, where some were proposing that if you're talking about unity, you cannot be for reconciliation, that it has to be one or the other. In fact, even a couple of weeks before Christmas, John Fitzgerald, an economist quite hostile to Irish unity, actually wrote an article saying that, you know, you cannot have a United Ireland unless we abolish academic selection in advance.
I'm not sure he is hostile to you in United Ireland.
Okay,
is that not Gareth Fitzgerald's son?
It is, but we have to respect every single individual, regardless of who their parents are.
Well, he's not here to defend himself, Chris.
The article is very clear, where he said that you cannot have a United Ireland unless you abolish academic selection.
Okay.
And you think about that, it's ridiculous, because unionist political parties are adamant that they don't want to change academic selection.
Okay, and I'll give you more time after the half nine news. I want to give David Graham a quick salvo.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, gentlemen. It's obviously interesting that Chris's mask has slipped so many times he doesn't bother putting it on anymore. And I mean, I think the reality of it is here, we see a situation that unionists are told change is coming, United Ireland's happening, get used to it. We can talk about a flag all we want, Mark. Flags will be seen across the world and interpreted in many different ways. I mean, I'm fairly ambivalent to this issue in terms of there are probably 101, 1,001 other hoops and issues that the United Irelanders need to convince people like me of, particularly around the economy, the use of currency and wider fundamental matters to a society and a country working before we worry about the colour of the cloth that flies above government buildings. The reality of it is the Irish tricolour was draped across a coffin as recently, I think, as last weekend with people who are up on murder charges related to Republican violence. So you can look at the tricolour and you can look at it in one extreme, like I've just given an example, and you can go right the way through to say, well, Irish tricolour's flown at Ireland rugby matches, for example, in which people from all communities in Northern Ireland are happy to go down and support. So, look, there are wider issues here. I think the problem, and I think that Sam has very cleverly, whether he's meant to or not, has highlighted and focused, smoked out, in fact, people like Chris, who clearly want to basically just tell unionists, well, you lot had it all your own way for too long,
okay,
and now you're going to basically suffer the sins of your forefathers. So,
I can feel Chris Donald.
I look forward to responding.
Yes. We're asking the question, does Dublin need to change the flag? Belfast Telegraph, Sam McBride is on the line, as is the former DUP special advisor, David Graham. He just had a pop at the former Sinn Féin candidate, Chris Donnelly. Chris, you want to return the serve?
Yes, yeah. Listen, and I saw some of this on Twitter yesterday. The phrase David used there, say, my mask had slipped and that Sam had somehow smoked people out. This is very interesting. Essentially, what David's saying is that if unionists right now are against changing the union flag, because we're not in a constitutionally neutral position, we who live in Northern Ireland are in the United Kingdom. So the logic of what David's saying is that his mask has slipped unless he comes on your show right now, and Sam's mask has slipped unless he also comes on your show right now and says that the flag of the United Kingdom needs to be changed immediately to reflect the identity of the Northern Nationalist population. You see, there's absolutely no logical argument for treating the national flag, and indeed the anthem, of the sovereign Irish nation any different to that of the UK with regard to sovereignty applying in the north of Ireland. That's why we have the three-stranded process. So what we're doing here is we're saying issues around equality, you know, unionism struggling to prepare for the equal playing field that must be in place with regard to a border poll.
Let's go back to the story.
50% plus one principle.
Okay, let's go back to the story. I mean, when you heard Judith Gillespie say what she said, as Sam outlined. Like, she was so honest. That's a problem with that gut reaction if someone like Judith Gillespie's thinking that about the Irish flag.
It's a problem, but not in the way I think you're presenting it. Firstly, Judith Gillespie, and by the way, I always like it when people are honest. So I appreciated hearing Judith, and I think it's important that people are allowed to speak honestly, and she has her job and fair play to her in Dublin at the moment. But where I think a lot of problem would have a difficulty, this is someone who had a senior role within policing. Now, the population in the north of Ireland, almost half the population north of Ireland would see the tricolour as our national flag. David made a comment about a tricolour being over a coffin. One would think that the British Army, loyalist paramilitary, simply didn't exist. One would think that the British state has not been involved in murder and all sorts of injustices in Ireland, and that the flag of the United Kingdom is not what they carried. I mean, for goodness sake, if we're going to say because a flag was on a coffin, then that has a problem. Well, you need to be consistent with that type of thinking. So I think the issue for someone like Judith is, yes, it reflects, I think, what we already understand, the fact that right now in the north of Ireland, half the population do not respect the fact that the Union flag is our national flag. But guess what? With the Good Friday Agreement, and we're 27 years after it, and we're living it. So I think part of the challenge is going to be to those who want to put forward Judith Gillespie's words and say, aha, that means you guys have to change. Actually, no. That actually means that there needs to be a discussion within unionism to say, well, hold on, we can't have our cake and eat it. We can't say that not only okay. will we not change the union flag, but remember only a few weeks ago there was talk about how dare people even suggest changes to the Ulster banner about the flag of this region. So, you know, there has to be a recognition that the change is not simply going to be for people who are in favour of Irish unity. The change also has to be for people who are going to, in the event of Irish unity, form the minority and use as their guide what happened in the post-Good Friday Agreement era for those of us who are the minority at the moment.
David Graham.
This conversation this morning probably highlights the attitude that someone like Chris would have towards unionists in a, inverted commas, New Ireland. And I think to go back to the point, this is the problem that we hear a lot about a New Ireland and how much unionists are going to be welcomed and members of the Orange Order will be welcomed. But the issue we have here that if it is a new country, right, let's just hypothecate for a second. Let's set aside the flimsy economic arguments, the flimsy wider cultural arguments, societal arguments, the massive issues that Sinn Féin have created for themselves down south, and they've highlighted that they struggle to run any sort of efficient administration. So let's park all those for a second and just talk about the hypothetical situation that there is a, in inverted commas, New Ireland. Well, in that case, then, surely there would be a new flag, a new national anthem, because it would be, in inverted commas, a new country. But I think, going back to Chris's point of the mask slipping, the problem is what Chris is actually saying is, well, you know what, the 32 counties, and basically you unionists and your children and your grandchildren, you'll basically just suck it up and like it, and if not,
Is that what happens at the moment, David? Is that what you tell your nationalist neighbours, that they're just sucking it up because the union flag is the flag of the north of Ireland?
Sorry, don't interrupt me, Chris. Come on. I'm being very consistent. If we go back to this argument that, you know, the union flag should be changed, well, at the moment, and based on the fact of the Belfast Agreement and the principle of consent and all the things that Republicans lauded after the good Republicans of the good terrorists out of jail in 1998, the fact of the matter is, Chris, this is the United Kingdom. And therefore, until the majority of people vote differently, the flag of the United Kingdom will be the union flag.
You're and making I think that my that point for me.
I'm making your point for you, but you've already said that if there is a united Ireland, then we would maintain the Irish tricolour. But the problem
precisely
is here,
because what you're arguing, what have you just articulated? You just articulated it that hasn't the union flag should stay in place.
At the moment?
Yes, that's what you've said.
Well, of course it would stay in place because it's the United Kingdom. My argument back
precisely,
to you
so sovereignty
saying,
transfers to right, Ireland. Why
Mark,
would that
can
not
you ask
fly?
Chris to stop interrupting me, please?
Well, there's a conversation, David, in fairness.
The problem with it is, Mark, that if there's going to be constitutional change, and I take that as a united Ireland, I think where Chris
is struggling to get the concept where he is clinging on to the hope that constitutional change means something's different, but he doesn't accept the fact that there will not be a majority anytime soon, perhaps not in either of our lifetimes, for a unification of the entire island. So I am saying if the island unifies one day, there should be a new flag. But until then, the symbols of the country as it is now will stay. That is my argument very clearly. So you can't have your cake and eat it, Chris, even though you spent the last 20 minutes dancing in the head of a pin.
I want to bring Sam McBride back in. Sorry, Chris. Sam, as I understand it, Sinn Féin's position is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there needs to be a discussion. They haven't a red line saying that United Ireland must have the same anthem, must have the same flag. Am I right or wrong in that?
To the best of my knowledge, that is where they stand. Certainly on many of these issues, Sinn Féin is very cautious about giving its own view, even around fairly basic things like should there be a federal arrangement?
Yes.
Should there be some sort of ongoing local Stormont in a new Ireland? All of those things, Sinn Féin is very careful, which is good politics. They're not tying themselves into that. But it means that this very credible idea of Irish unity, and it is a serious idea, it's a much more serious idea post-Brexit than it was before Brexit, where it was not in any way possible in terms of the future that we could see at that point. It is a serious idea that needs to be taken seriously. And a lot of the commentary about this is sort of tribal positioning for or against, not getting into the detail of what it would actually mean. And I think that when you look at this issue of the flag or the anthem or the Commonwealth or any of these issues that are purely symbolic, they will not change anybody's life one iota. What they really get to is how people see themselves. They symbolize deeper issues that would have to change if this was going to be a successful country. It could, as Chris says, absolutely be the case that if there's a 50% plus one vote for Irish unity, in which case there absolutely has to be Irish unity. That's the law. That's the logical position. There's no getting away from that. If that happens, you can keep the tricolour. You can keep everything the way it is right now. But is that the most sensible way to go if you're a nationalist? I don't think it is.
Chris?
Yeah, I think there's actually two points there. And Sam's making a very good point. Number one, there is no unionist veto, and we cannot frame this as unionists never accepting the tricolour. David's point, David talked himself in circles because he essentially said, right now it's right to have the union flag because it's United Kingdom sovereignty. But if sovereignty transfers to Ireland, the game has to be completely changed. The Irish can't have their flag. And that demonstrates something. There's a fundamental disrespect, a disregard within political unionism for the sovereignty of the Irish state, and the fact that the Irish state is on a level, not with us in the north, we're the contested entity. The Irish state is on a level with the United Kingdom. And I think the nearer we get towards having serious, credible discussions about unity, people are going to recognize, hold on, people in the south are just like people in Great Britain. They're quite fond of the flag. Okay. They're quite fond of the national anthem. And therefore, the parameters of the discussion have to be set in a realistic way, and they have to be recognised as being consistent across the board. Okay. So if we have a United Kingdom at the moment, a union flag, God save the Queen or King, then people can't really argue if that transfers to Ron Levein and the tricolour.
David, I'll bring you back in. Chris is playing the man a lot as well as the ball. I don't know what he had for breakfast, or maybe his team lost at the weekend. Did they, Chris? Did you? Is that why you're in bad form this morning?
Friday night we lost to Lorne. Don't get me
that's
started
right,
on that.
That's
now.
Right. That's right. Manchester United are back, mind you. That's the big sporting fair, story Mark, the weekend. Sorry, go on ahead, David. Then I want to bring in our callers.
To be fair, Mark, I think if you want to find a subject that Chris and I will agree on, I've absolutely no idea why Cliftonville's first goal was ruled out on Friday night.
Oh, my
but
goodness.
Anyway, we'll move on.
Oh, my goodness. Peace in our time.
He has broken out. I love it.
We'll move on. I think the point is, look, and again, listen, this is no disrespect to the subject matter as a whole. I think that if I follow Chris's argument and line of thinking, really what we actually need to do is get in the time machine, go back to the early 1920s and say, right, we've got a new country here, and actually the Ulster banner or a flag needs to represent Northern Ireland, and the Union Jack won't work because of all the links to the black and tans and all the bad things that the Brits have done over the previous hundreds and hundreds of years. So I think the problem that I have now, setting aside, as again, in fear of repeating myself here, about all the economic issues and the wider problems that I see with unification, is if from a UNIS point of view, I always thought that we were being sold this pop of it will be a new country, but it clearly actually won't be a new country. Okay. What it'll be is we'll all be assimilated into the current Irish Republic.
Well, let's see. Well, let's see. Sammy's on the line from Belfast. Hi, Sammy. Happy Monday to you.
Happy Monday to you. I have a challenge for you, Mark, and all BBC Radio Ulster journalists. Try doing a week and then try doing a month without carrying a sectarian story and concentrate on the four big issues that affect every person in this country every day. And my Baptist fully charged, so I'll tell you what they are. Housing. 17,000 planning applications.
Just give us the four, Sammy. We will come back. Give us the four. Housing, what else?
It's alliteration. Housing and health, education and the economy. And okay. Here's the best examples.
Okay.
Housing. 17,000 okay. housing applications okay. stalled because we don't have a sewer.
Okay.
Health. MLAs who prefer to argue and squabble about flags and curbstones and posters and sectarian stuff, and the journalists feed into it okay. rather than reform our health service. Education. What is happening in education? Parents, pupils, school governors, everybody wants integrated, but the education ministers meeting paramilitaries.
Sammy, hold that thought for one moment, speaking of education. Chris Donnelly needs to go back to his day job. Chris Donnelly, before you go, are we right to be talking about this or not?
Look, we don't talk about this exclusively. I think it's very important in society. We don't just shout at each other. We do talk. We do engage. Sam has done a service by having this article because it's allowed the conversation not just happen between myself and David, but the listeners out there. Now, you can read me in the Irish News. Normally, every fortnight, I'm talking about education matters these days as well. So it's not like we ignore other matters like education, housing. Those are incredibly important. They're going to be even more important in the future. But, you know, we can do more than one thing at one time. And in our society, because of the divisions within it, it's very important that we do.
We can walk and chew gum. Have
Absolutely.
A good day, Chris Donnelly. Back
Take
to you.
Care now.
Thank you. Thank you. Back to you, Sammy. Just a last quick word on this.
I don't think they can walk and chew gum because they're not, because, you know, the economy, like Brexit. You, I, and me, and the Beagle Hound sitting beside me, who has just returned to the fold after half an hour AWOL on the golf course, he could become an agent for a company in Britain to get round the Windsor Protocol and make a fortune. You know, those four things, Mark, and that's a challenge for you and every BBC journalist. Can you go for a week and then a month without doing sectarian broadcasting? I'm serious.
Sammy, I hear you. We'll think about it. We'll keep talking. We'll keep talking. That's the main thing. And thanks for listening. And keep phoning in. Brian's phoned in as well. Morning, Brian.
Oh, good morning, Mark. Where I come from, born reared in the Falls Road, Mark, and I know what people say.
Not a great line, Brian.
Sorry, can you hear me now? Can you hear me?
We'll give you one last go. Go, go.
Oh, well, anyway, the people know that certain politicians within unionism, especially DUP, TUV, some of the stipends coming from them all during the years, they dislike, rather than use the word I want to use, they dislike anything to do with the Republic of Ireland. You had an example last week in the Telegraph with Gregory Campbell complaining about the Ulster University promoting the image of the GAA. Now, what's that all about?
In fairness to Gregory Campbell, I think he felt that there should be more other sports included, not just GAA. I think that was Gregory Campbell's point.
I think he had a more sinister thought behind it, to be honest with you, Mark. I mean, this is where you get examples of people... unionists, DUP, all down the years, Mark, time I make a big list and ring in some more day of what they say about the Republic of Ireland. They don't want nothing to do with it. They still think of it as a Catholic state, and that's their stupidity anyway.
And Brian, would it help, do you think, take away some of those fears if the Irish Republic changed the flag in a new Ireland?
Yes, definitely, yeah. Okay. But they still won't satisfy, I'll be honest with you, Mark, they still won't satisfy them, to be honest with you. They have this total dislike of anything, the culture of the Irish culture, sports and so forth.
Okay.
They want to rot down. You hear
your line's going again, Brian, okay. But I think we've got your point. So Brian's not totally against changing the flag. What about Tony and Lagmore? What do you think, Tony?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I heard the unionist politician.
Tony, you're sounding like a Dalek there, unfortunately. I think you said definitely not. Apologies if I've misquoted you. Well,
no, he hasn't. And what else in saying about that is, you have, he mentioned about the orange borders.
Sorry, Tony, like it's not good enough. It's not good enough, you're lying. Sam, back to you. If there is going to be a new flag, has any research been done over the years? We might need Dominic Bryan back on about what a new Irish flag might look like.
Well, actually, you could do a whole programme on that, Mark, but probably that's not what some of your callers want you to do on this topic. There are some fascinating new designs out there, actually quite old designs. If you look at Brendan O'Leary's book, I can't remember which side of the fence he comes down on, whether he thinks they should change the flag or not. But I do remember that there are some very nice colour photos of a sort of quite royal blue, if I've got it right, banner with a gold harp on it, which is one of the ancient flags. Is it used by the Irish president at the moment? There's a gold there's a gold banner on a green background, which was used by the local Presbyterian Irishmen who rose up against British rule in 1798. There is probably quite controversial for those reasons, but there are lots of possibilities there. I think that if you look at something that Chris said though, there is a massive problem that locally Northern Ireland doesn't have any flag that can unite people. There is the Ulster banner. It was never actually the flag of Northern Ireland. It's used sometimes by people like Rory McIlroy or whatever, because there's nothing else essentially. That's something that potentially could unite people for different reasons. For unionists, it could say, look, here's something that's good for the union because Scotland has a flag, England, Wales, we don't have one. For nationalists, it could say, look, this is something that could bring people together if Northern Ireland continues, as I think is probably the most feasible form of Irish unity, to go on, if you like, at least in a staging post era, if you want to use that phrase from Jim Allister, after a vote for Irish unity. If you keep Stormont, if you keep lots of the emblems of Northern Ireland, having something that people can unite around is actually quite important. Good in the here and now, whatever happens in the future.
Tony, you're back.
I'm back. Can you hear me okay, man?
Yes, go for it.
Right. Now, I heard him, the unionists are talking about the loyal orange orders and flags and this, that and the other. It's funny that there's plenty of orange orders in the south of Ireland. And then, they march in Ross Nulla, and they've no problem about that. So why should they have a problem with the Irish tricolour if it is the flag of the country?
And Tony, remind me, you did break up when I asked you directly, would you accept a new flag in a new Ireland?
I don't see why.
Okay.
The flag, hold on, I'm from a mixed family. My father was Protestant, my mother was Catholic, right? Green is for Catholics, white is for peace, and orange is for the Orange or Orange Order. Now, remember, the Orange Order only exists in the north of Ireland, doesn't exist really in Scotland, maybe. Anywhere else, it's a religious group.
They you just said about Ross Nulla. It's in the south as well.
That's what I mean. They march there.
Okay.
So what's the difference?
Okay. I take your point. They don't necessarily see it that way. But Tony, you're entitled to your view. Thanks for phoning in this bright Monday morning. Joe's on the line from Collybackie. Hi, Joe.
You're talking about the possible future flag. There's a problem with the existing flag. In the 1920s, the smart Irish patriots who designed the flag made it green, white and orange. And the orange was to include the Protestant community.
Yes.
But if you talk to most nationalists, and it rings into the GAA, you take the great Gaelic county of Kerry, it's green and gold. Most Irish people talk about the Irish tricolour as being green, white and gold. They will not refer to it as being orange. But the guys who designed it were smart men, and they realised that the orange would accommodate the Protestant community. But it's never been accepted by the most nationalists in Ireland. They talk about the green, white and gold.
How do you know most, Joe? How do you know most?
Well, I've got relations live in Dublin.
Okay.
I've got relations live in Clare.
Okay.
And right. I mean, but just look at the GAA.
Okay.
And let me tell you something. Right. I saw. I was in a Cook Park in 1962 and saw the great Christian Ring.
You did
and,
not.
On Ollie Weiss. I'm now 84, and in the last number of years, I've always been a great favourite of. I think Hurling is a great game.
Certainly is. Certainly is. Joe, thank you. A little trip down memory lane. Brian's on the line from Inniskillen. How are you, Brian?
Morning, Mark. How are we today?
What do you think?
Well, firstly, I'm not a big fan of Sinn Féin, but I'm also not a fan of the patronising conversation that the unionist guy, what's his first name again?
David Graham.
David. I really find David Graham's patronising conversation this morning quite wrong. You know, it's like this. Whenever there's a referendum, and there will be one someday, whether I'm in favour of a United Ireland or not is not the point. My issue here this morning is the talking down of nationalism by David Graham this morning will do one simple thing, because it even irritated me a bit. It would make me think in a greater fashion that I would be classed as fed up with listening to the David Grahams and having to accept David Graham's version of everything in Northern Ireland. And when the Good Friday Agreement happened and people were forced to agree, the point is that I have the same equality in this planet and in Northern Ireland as David Graham, which includes if there ever was a referendum.
Okay.
And the point I'm making is that if unionism wants to remain fresh and healthy, it really needs to stop the David Grahams talking in such almost as if somebody like me is a second-class citizen. And also, could I just say, republicanism isn't, in my opinion, the argument here. Nationalism and the Protestant community are fed up with things.
Brian, sorry to interrupt. I get the impression you're not a member of the David Graham fan club. David Graham is still on the line. You've got 1 minute to give the David Graham response.
Well, I mean, I'm not really on here to talk about David Graham, Mark. obviously, your caller there has got out of the wrong side of the bed this morning. But, I mean, the reality of it is I have highlighted the point that, as far as I am concerned, no one has yet to give me any sort of compelling argument for where I would be, you know, as your caller said, where David Graham would be in a United Ireland. And I don't speak on behalf of anyone, but what I would say is, when I speak to a lot of people from a wide range of backgrounds, there are a number, hundreds if not thousands of issues that need to be dealt with prior to worrying about the colour of the cloth hanging over government buildings. So, look, I mean, if that's patronising and one thing and all, then listen, that's fine, Mark. As far as I am concerned, as things stand at the minute, it is a flimsy argument at best for United Ireland, and I think that the arguments that have come on here this morning are flimsy still, because whether this is patronising or not, I get the impression that someone like me is basically told, look, suck it up, change is happening, get used to it, and if you don't like it, well, it's going to happen anyway. So that's probably reflective of quite a few unionists.
I'm not telling you to suck it up, but I may have to ask you politely to shut up. Sorry, I shouldn't really say it like that. But it's coming up to the news, David Graham. Thank you very much indeed. We will return to this issue, I'm sure, unless our caller who doesn't want us to talk about flags gets his way. We're going to talk about the priest's retirement and we're going to talk about airport drop-offs after the 10 o'clock news. I think we all need to calm down a bit, including me. Have a listen to this. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that just what we need after talking about flags for 45 minutes? That was, of course, Bathurst Martin O'Hagan, Eugene O'Hagan and David De Largy, better known as the priest,
The bad news, folks, is they've been singing together for 50 years, but they're going to stop performing. They've been performing professionally as the Priests for the last two decades, but no more. They're hanging up their microphones. Delighted to have Father Eugene O'Hagan on the line this morning. Good morning, Father Eugene.
Good morning, Mark. Morning, everybody.
Is it over?
Well, we've completed this stage of a very unexpected journey. And we decided that given the anniversary, 50 years that you mentioned, and almost two decades as the Priests, that there's a time when a journey must come to a, as we describe it, a celebratory conclusion.
You still have your voices.
Oh,
in,
yes.
In an amateur way, maybe at Mass, will you still be singing?
Oh, yeah, we're not going to stop singing in that. In that sense, oh yes, we'll be singing at Mass. And we'll sing locally. One or two of us have already received a couple of invitations to join local choirs with their concert programmes. So that's great. And that's the kind of thing we were doing before we were, in a sense, discovered in 2008. So we'll continue doing that for as long as the voices last out.
Is it going to be a bit like Frank Sinatra, though? You're going to have all these comeback tours.
We're not anticipating that, it must be said. But you never know. People say never say never. But at the moment, anyway, this stage of our journey, we decided to bring it to a celebratory conclusion in the Ulster Hall on January the 5th, just before the beginning of at the beginning of the new year and at the end of the Christmas season. So it was a wonderful event and a wonderful concert. And it gave us an opportunity simply to say thanks to all those who had travelled with us for well nigh 20 years.
Looking back, was there one moment where you were pinching yourself and looking at who was listening to you, whether it was the Pope, the President or members of the British Royal Family, and thought, my goodness, is this really happening?
Well, I think we have a number of pinch bruises, you may say. you've identified quite a number of them, yes. And, of course, one of the biggest ones was, I think, after the release of the first album in 2008, we sang in the what was the Odyssey, the arena in Belfast, to a capacity audience of our own, shall we say, communities, where and our own families and our own friends. So that was particularly special, it must be said. That was at the very beginning of the journey. And then after that, as you've mentioned, quite a number of encounters with celebrities in the civil society, and of course on our own boss, you may say, the Pope, which was in a sense a stamp of approval from him, which was very encouraging, to say the very least.
And speaking of the boss, the Catholic Church has been very good to you in terms of letting you pursue this musical passion.
That's true. You know, we've always, of course, been singing, and so our colleagues have always been very supportive of all that we've done, and our superiors, the bishops, etc. I think they've seen it as part of our kind of gentle evangelization with a small e through the beauty of music, and inviting and encouraging people to hear a sound that they may find attractive, and then, you know, perhaps go beyond simply the sound to the message, because some of the songs, of course, we sing are from the classical religious repertoire. It's not exclusively so, but, you know, that little bit of a presence on the airwaves and in the marketplace is very helpful and a good thing.
Have you a favourite song that you've sung over the years?
Oh, gosh. You're asking me a very difficult question. But I suppose one of the ones that I think always resonates with people is Schubert's Ave Maria. It's one of the timeless classics, it has to be said. And every singer wants to sing it. And we always included it in all our concerts. So it probably would be one of the favourites.
And two last things, Father Eugene. The power of music, first of all. I mean, I joked before I introduced that little melody or montage of some of your musical hits that, you know, we all needed a bit of music to calm us down. I genuinely feel better having heard you this morning. There is a power there. It's not imaginary.
No, there is a power to music, yes. I mean, we all have our favourite pieces, and when we do want to kind of get away from the hustle and bustle of everyday life, we turn on, you know, are we on our iPhone or whatever medium we may use, we reach out for the piece of music that will calm us and that will kind of and encourage us and give mm-hmm. us a sense of hope in the midst of bad news and difficulties. Yeah, I think we all have that go-to piece of music or pieces of music, whether it's singing or instrumental or rock or classical, religious or you know, contemporary. It's a resource and it's a comfort to everyone.
It certainly is a comfort. I'm not going to ask you any more questions. I just want to listen to you again. Father Eugene, thank you to you and thank you to your colleagues for all the music and the gifts that you've brought to us. Beautiful. The priests, thank you for all that you've done. And your music is still available, and thanks for allowing us to play some of it on the Nolan Show this morning. Now to an issue that has come up on the programme quite a bit in recent years, drop-offs at our airports. At Belfast City Airport at the weekend, according to one social media customer or passenger at Belfast City Airport, they got fined. They got a letter saying they'd been charged £60 for dropping off outside the parking zone at Belfast City Airport. Tim Cairns put this on the social media platform X. He said he couldn't see any signage telling him that he could be fined if he was dropped off outside the official drop-off zone. But of course, there's a health and safety issue there. We're going to hear from Belfast City Airport in terms of a statement in a moment or two. But first, let's talk to the travel writer and blogger Tim Hedgley. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Mark.
Do you know much about this? Is this new at Belfast City Airport, or have they been fining people for years and we just didn't know about it?
No, it's a new thing. There are signs up all over the entrance to the airport, and that is on the private land side. And I went and had a look at the signs this morning. Now, one of the problems, I can understand the reason for this. It's to force passengers or drivers to go into the car park and hand over their £3 to drop off. Now, £3 is not a lot of money. All airports charge for it, but this is a new departure where they're basically saying to people, you cannot stop. Now, from a legal point of view, I'm not a lawyer, but I question whether or not they actually have the right to do that. They can impose on private land parking restrictions, but if you stop your car and somebody gets out, that's not parking. Or is it? But I understand why they're doing it. It's probably one of the most convenient airports in the whole of the world. And they're doing this to regulate traffic flow in and out of the car park. So I understand why they're doing it. And the signposts are there. But the problem is, when you're driving, you can see the signs, but you cannot engage with the signs as entering into a contract, which these parking charge notices rely on. They rely on contract law to enforce these. And my question would be, if you're driving, you cannot stop to read the sign. Therefore, you have no chance to enter into that contract. But that's for the legal beagles to sort out. But the signs are there. I saw them this morning.
Well, Belfast City Airport say that there are approximately 60 signs and they're clearly displayed across the site advising motorists that stopping within a no-stop zone will incur a penalty notice of up to £100 or £60 if paid within 14 days. This information is also available on our website. 10 minutes free parking is still available for all motorists whilst using our long stay car park just a short walk from the terminal. Tim?
Yeah, I would agree that there are 60 signs, but not all of them contain the information that you will receive a £100 fine or a £60 fine or whatever it is. There are signs all over the place saying no stopping. The problem with parking charge notices, and I'm sure that the Consumer Council will be pricking their ears up at this because they defend Northern Irish citizens who get parking charge notices. They are all over this like a rash. The problem is you don't have the opportunity to exit the airport back onto a public road if you do not agree with the signage. Once you've gone through the front gates of the airport, you are caught by this regulation or regime and you don't have the ability to exit without being in that no-stopping area. And that's an issue. Whereas
I don't quite understand what you're saying, Tim, because I have driven into the airport and then you can drive out again under the underpass.
That's correct. But once you drive into the airport, you are there. You are caught by this new regulation. You have no opportunity to not be caught by this regulation because it covers the whole of the roads in the airport.
You go into the car park and you can go for free to the long stay for 10 minutes.
Correct. But you are still, if you stop on the road, you know the small piece of road outside where the taxis sit?
Yes.
The road that takes you to the underpass. Well, that now has been red lined. So there are double red lines along there. Say, for example, you stop or your phone goes and you stop, you pull in and stop, take a phone call. Then straight away, you will have breached the conditions and you could receive a £100 fine for doing that.
In fairness, Tim, it's not a great place to stop. It could be dangerous to stop there.
Absolutely. And I spoke to the airport and they explained that people were actually dropping off passengers in the middle of roundabouts, which is madness to save £3. So the best advice you can give, as I did this morning when dropping off a passenger, pay your £3. Exit safely and everybody gets a safe flight.
Look, there was me thinking you just went especially for us. You had a passenger to drop off, had you?
I did. Yes,
ah, Tim, you've just outed yourself. We thought you went for the good of your heart. So,
Well, at the end of the day, I've never seen those signs before and there are a lot of them.
Okay.
But there are only a small number that actually say what the penalty is. The other ones just say no stopping, etc., etc.
I think they've been there for a while. Somebody was telling me in my ear, I think they were saying those signs and this new regime has been in place since November. I think that's right.
Well, there we are. 12 weeks.
12 so. Weeks.
Yeah.
Tim, what do you think of it? Big picture, what do you think of this regime?
I think it's a bit of a large hammer to crack a nut. And I'm certain from my studies, I studied law at university, and I'm certain that parking charge notices are massive for solicitors. They take on these companies all the time because of the law that's behind them. It's not public law, it's civil law. So I'm sure somebody will challenge it, and they will probably challenge it for the reason that once you go through the gates of Belfast City Airport, you're onto private land and you cannot exit from the regime that has been put in place if you inadvertently pull in and stop and, take a phone call. You could be caught for £100.
You say it's a large hammer to crack a nut. Could it be a large hammer to make a few quid?
You said that. I couldn't possibly comment.
I asked the question. Stay with us, Tim. Donald's on the line. Donald, have you been caught?
I was caught twice last month, sir, coming up to Christmas.
Oh, Donald.
£200 fine. It shows you plain. They've sent me the readout of it, and it shows you on the wee roundabout, as you know, as you're saying there, when you go in, up over the underpass.
Yes.
At that wee roundabout, Michael, he used to stand. I've lived in there 10 years. And lately, I never even noticed it. But anyway, in the last coming for Christmas there, he was over twice. And they got me the twice. And he was standing waiting with his bag. He threw it in the back of the car, into the car and away. It wasn't 30 seconds, £100.
Who's Michael Donald?
Father Cunningham. He works in England, but he comes over. He was over his father's not too well.
God
and
bless.
He was doing a couple of jumps back and forth.
Well, that was an expensive pickup, Donald.
Not paying that pet. Sure, they'll feed him in the tumbler up in McGarver. Or somewhere, sure, I wouldn't pay that for 30 seconds.
You're
the
not paying it.
No, well, not that. Not a chance of paying.
Well,
no,
we'll check out whether you're breaking the law or not, Donald.
I'm not breaking the law. Sure, they can't come here to lift it. I was always told Northern Ireland, them English crowd can't come over here.
But rules are rules. You were on their property. Do you not have a moral obligation, even if you don't have a legal obligation, to pay your fine?
So if your car broke down or something, you're going to get done for £100. What happens there in a case of that?
Your car didn't break down, Donald, unless you're going to claim that now.
No, I'm not. But I'm sure not paying it, I'll tell you. £100 for 3 seconds. I've heard of rip-offs. That's a big one.
Well, it's not £100. It's £120 for the two £60 fines if you had paid them within 14 days. I take it you're beyond 14 days now?
No, it was only in the 20th or December. I was not near enough.
I think you've missed the boat there, Donald. What are you saying to Belfast City Airport this morning? Now you know the rules. Are you going to obey the rules?
I never was on the planes and I've never been to again in my life. I don't care how they can walk out. They can walk the Belfast as they want. Never through the gate of you. Never be through it. Sure, that is unreal, like, is it not?
Health and safety, Donald. You mean it's you know, it's a busy airport. A lot of people coming and going. You were there just before Christmas. Dear knows what could have happened if you stop your car suddenly at a roundabout.
It's not. There's nobody meeting you or anything. It's an impossibility. Nothing can happen. The guy was standing there 2 seconds just into the car and away. Can't happen.
Mark, if I could just say one thing, I think your caller there, Donald, I think he should contact the Northern Ireland Consumer Council, because parking charge notices have to be proportionate and they have to be reasonable. Now, I would also wonder, the piece of road that he's talking about is the road, the mini roundabout at the underpass. It would take somebody with a good set of maps to actually work out, is that actually Belfast City Airport's ground or is that public property?
But you're actually out of the airport.
Well, that's why I'm suggesting that. So that you would need to, Donald, you'd need to get that checked out. This is not legal advice because I can't give legal advice. But what I would suggest you do is speak to the Consumer Council and they will give you the chapter and verse on what has happened there.
But can you check, just when you're out of there, you check it out that if these boys can come. I don't think they're allowed to come to Belfast or if they're come to the door or do anything.
We'll check that out. You're getting free advice there from Tim. Tim, you're going to put Holly Hamilton out of a job here. Now she's doing on your behalf. Anyway.
Well, she should take that one up.
Has, and we're late to the party here. We'll check that out. I wonder if Connor Phillips has ever got one. He uses that airport quite a lot. Maybe we'll have to ask him. We'll get him on tomorrow because he uses the airport quite a bit. Like, a couple more quick calls, then we want to talk about Ed Sheeran. Robert, the taxi driver. Robert, what do you think?
Morning, Mark. Mark, it's disgraceful what they do at that airport. 2 points is, taxis go in there on a lot of occasions. It costs £3 to go into the airport, £3 to come out again. It's very unfair because the buses that do an hourly service to both airports are £3 charges. They go free. If one part of the transport system can drop into the airport and come out again, it's free. We've always been aware of them red lanes right around the city airport. It's disgraceful. And another point that nobody has raised, taxi drivers across the country have lost. What that actual airport has done this past, I think it's about 2 years it's been now, when we brought that £3 charge in, you were able to drop off and pick up. They're taking the taxi driver's tips. You don't get a tip now. You pick up a member of the public and they want to go to the George Best Airport or the International Airport, you have to say to them, sorry, it's an extra £3 on top of the meter.
Okay, Robert.
You know, it's disgraceful.
We hear you. And 10 seconds from John and Ballyclare, and then I want to talk about Ed Sheeran. John.
Good morning, Mark. Your caller, your last person on there, not the last, the one before that, was saying that all airports apply this fee, £3, drop off and pick up. Dublin Airport doesn't do it.
Good point, John. I checked this out. You're absolutely right. Do you know what? Let's talk about this more tomorrow. Oh, my goodness, it's only Monday. I'm exhausted. More music, please. More music. Oh, Ed Sheeran. I think I'm the only person that didn't meet him at the weekend. We're hearing lots of great stories, including he went into Matchett's in the centre of Belfast. Is that right? The owner of Matchett's, Neil Crowther's on the line. Morning, Neil.
Morning, Mark.
Did you meet him?
Yeah, oh yes. We had a meeting in the shop with him on Friday afternoon.
Did you know he was coming? I take it you did.
We did, yes. We had a meeting with Renuka from his foundation in October, about planning, doing stuff for Ed's foundation. And then I got a phone call just before Christmas saying that he'd be coming on Friday.
I think, Neil, what a lot of people have been saying, you hear about these foundations that start in England and those behind them, even though they're supposed to be UK-wide, don't cross the Irish Sea. But he came over. How was he?
He was brilliant. He was so engaged with the teachers. He wanted to know what their struggles were, how, and the problem in Northern Ireland is it is very sort of divided. There's a lot of good stuff going on, but in a lot of areas with deprivation, the schools are struggling, and music is a luxury. And it's close to his heart. He listened, and he really wants to help.
So that's why he has founded this foundation, is to try and spread music to areas of deprivation, to people who maybe can't afford instruments or don't get the same opportunities that others with a bit more money might have.
Yeah, that's exactly what he does. It's close to his heart. He can see the benefits, not, you know, just through exams or earning money, but just music's such a good thing for kids. It helps in so many other ways. And you know, it's helped me through my life a lot of times. You know, everybody who does music enjoys it. As he said in the meeting, he said it was a way of him getting his feelings and expressions out in a way that was safe. So, you know, and he just wants to open it up for more children out there.
I hate to ask this, Neil, but did he buy anything or did he have a good look around your stock?
He did buy a guitar.
What?
He bought a Loudon, caught his eye, and he says he likes to go into local shops and support them, so it was very generous of him.
Neil, I honestly didn't know that, and I thought as I asked that question, you're going to have to give me a very disappointed answer. Well, he had a good look round, and he liked our stock, and he said a lot of nice things. Oh, my goodness, I'm sure you didn't expect that.
No, I thought he would be in, because when you get the email with the itinerary, it's all 5 minutes for this, 5 minutes for that, and you think, oh, is he going to? But he did. He took some time, had a chat, got photos. He was a gent, absolute gent.
Absolute gent, and boy can he sing. Neil, thanks very much indeed. It's been a bit of rough and tumble. There's been a bit of rough and tumble on the show today. Thanks for listening. Thanks to my wife, Catherine, who helped nurse me over the weekend. I got the lurgy. I'm back. Have a listen to Ed Sheeran, and we'll see you tomorrow. To go on and I'm on my way. I still remember these old country lanes when we did not know the answers, and I miss the way you made me feel. It's real when we watch the sunset
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.